Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems. But getting therapy has its own problems too. Like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable, too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at UH1.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
The following is a presentation of the Four Center podcast feed.
From the center of the galaxy, this is the Four Center podcast feed. I'm Ken Napsack for another edition of Star Wars Rank. Me and a guest ranking things in Star Wars because, man, ranking's fun. And someone who has fun ranking with me a lot, and he's here today, is Joseph Scrimshaw. Hello, friend.
Happy for some ranking fun.
Some ranking file fun. We are coming up on, it's hard to fathom, but we're coming up on 1,000 total broadcasts for Force Center, Joseph, and this is our 115th edition of Star Wars Ranked. Just when you think, hey, you know, have we ranked the end of the galaxy? Yeah, something new and cool pops up, you know?
Yeah, there's still so much left to rank.
Yeah, we haven't even got down to Chief Chirpa's wardrobe. I can't wait to rank that. today, we have got in our hands this book we've had for a bit now. We both really enjoyed it. It's a fun little quick reader. It's called Star Wars Fascinating Facts, Story, Lore, and History from the Greatest Galaxy by Pablo Hidalgo. A lot of you know who Pablo is, and he recently returned to public Twitter. He's, back out there slugging it away. We'll see how long that lasts, Joseph. And this is a fun little book with great little facts, right? And this is, landed in our hands, and it's nice and small and fits there, and it's fun to read.
Yeah, this is I would say the Fascinating Facts book is a fascinating book to me because Pablo Hidalgo is obviously somebody who knows Star Wars from every aspect, from the story to the behind the scenes history. He probably wrote this book in his sleep, literally. And I mean that as a compliment. But this book is fascinating because it is clearly one of those. Does your niece like Star Wars and they need something for their birthday and you know nothing about Star Wars? This, you can grab this book. That's what feels like the kind of the brutal book market point of a book like this is.
Yeah.
But it is fascinating to me because it clearly fulfills that, you know, book market need. But it is for a book that could be marketed like that. It is actual fascinating facts for people like us and our listeners who are very all in on Star Wars. So what a great mix to kind of fill that need of just like, I know this person in my life likes the Star Wars, but it's still full of actual fascinating facts for people who know Star Wars.
Yeah. And, you know, Pablo's got he's got a long, rich history there, and he's been involved in a lot of different eras and aspects of creating Star Wars, documenting Star Wars, and keeping its histories and lores. Him and Leland Shi, the keeper of the Holocron, they do such a great job. So it makes sense. And like I said, he would just kind of write this book in his sleep, it would seem. But what I also love, too, and it's funny, as of the day we're recording this, he did tweet something out or commented on something I saw about a making of Empire Strikes Back thing about Luke being pushed out of the window or sucked out of the window during the fight with Vader and Bespin. And he made an interesting thing. He says, you know, not everyone grew up on the same behind the scenes specials. So a lot of people, I'm paraphrasing now, but I'm joyed that a lot of new people are finding this out. And that struck a chord with me because we always talk about our generation. We are that kind of maybe first, second generation of Star Wars fans, young kids when they had hit. We've lived with those VHS tapes and a lot of these behind the scenes stories, which a lot are in these books. But I love that the purpose is, like you said, Joseph, you got a niece, you got a nephew, you got someone in your life want learning Star Wars. Take this and enjoy the same stories we did.
Yeah, exactly. And this is such a great covering of all of the different eras too. So I think there's even that thing of like, well, kids who grew up with the prequels maybe remember all those facts, you know. Totally. And this is just covers all the eras.
Yeah, so we're going to dive in. We've picked our five favorite plus some runner-ups, as always, of our favorite little fascinating facts. Some are very familiar to us. Some are relatively new when this book plopped into our laps, and others are very purposeful and tell a point. This is kind of a fun list and a great mix today. So we're going to begin, Joseph, with your number five.
Yeah, my number five is titled Critical Reception. Just to give a little peek into my process, when I read this book a while back, I took pictures of the pages I liked, but I did it late at night and I failed to take pictures that included the page number. So if you're following along, I apologize. I have no idea what page number this is, but I have a lovely photo of it on my phone. Anyway, it is titled Critical Reception. All of these facts are just like one little page, a fun photo. Here is the actual text from Critical Reception, my number five. Pablo Hidalgo writes, George Lucas famously did not pay much heed to critics and stood behind his work regardless of professional reception. During the production of Episode One, Lucas could be spotted wearing a T-shirt with a review of Star Wars on it. A closer inspection revealed it was more than met the eye. The text is from a New Yorker story about the film's 20th anniversary and reads, Star Wars, a film with comic book characters, unbelievable story, no political or social commentary, lousy acting, preposterous dialogue, and ridiculously simplistic morality. In other words, a bad movie. So I do think that there are some choices in the facts that Pablo Hidalgo puts in here. Some of them are absolutely fun. Some of them are movie magic, and some of them are reinforcing perspectives. And this is reinforcing a perspective, a truth that George Lucas doesn't care that George Lucas is aware of the strange tension of having created one of the most popular things ever to exist within humanity, and also something that is constantly and viciously criticized. Yeah. And that he is so aware of that tension that he would wear a t-shirt that calls it out while making more of this thing that causes such great tension.
And making this set of three films that's going to explode this tension. Just
yeah, yeah. And that's, I think what's really fascinating to me about this, a couple things, just that, you know, we talk about sometimes kind of even jokingly about George Lucas as the rebel in flannel. And I bang on sometimes about Lucas being an auteur. And I think sometimes people are like, yeah. But really what I mean by that is he, I think, approaches these films, even though they are, you know, incredibly popular and change the entertainment landscape as we know it. He approaches them as, this is the movie I want to make. And I recognize that it is going to come under lots of fire. And I live with that. And I'm not going to let that critique change my mind about the story I want to tell. And fully appreciating that is one of the many things that made me just let go and study and enjoy the prequels for what they are, because they are absolutely the exercise of somebody just making exactly the film that they want. And that is, you know, at least partially what the sort of auteur theory is about. And just to strip it of the auteur label, which can have some different baggage and meaning, I just think about it this way of, you sit down and you write a story and you ask a bunch of friends, you know, is it good? Is it bad? And a bunch of friends, some of them like it, some of them don't. A bunch of friends want to tell you, this is the story you should write. And instead of critiquing your story, they just kind of tell you to write a different story. Yeah. And then you go, wait, no. After thinking about it, I trust myself. I wrote the story I wanted to, and I'm proud of it. And I'm going to stay in that space. Yeah. It's not about not taking criticism. It's about being true to, I know I made what I wanted to make, and I'm going to accept that some people are going to love it and some people are going to hate it. And I'm going to wear a t-shirt that reflects that.
Yeah. Yeah. No, well said, man. This is a great way to start the list here, because this is, I do believe there's a little bit of communication going on from Pablo to the fandom, you know, and I don't mean that in a negative sense at all, just a little, very curated list at times. Some, like I said, some of them fun and fluffy, and others like, hey, I know there's this narrative out here, but let me use a fact to drop in your narrative soup and see where you want to take it. And this is one of them for me. And George has got a sense of humor, you know, I mean, I haven't hung out with him, but you know, it seems like he does. He, you know, the Han shot first shirt he was seen in several times on set. Famously loving Hardware Wars and that parody back in the day. And then one day I think we're going to see him in a McClunky beanie. I really do. Like, you know, this is part of his nature. But again, it all feeds into what you're saying, Joseph, of, I get it. It's a silly space opera. But I know who I am as a storyteller. I know what I'm trying to do. And I'm building my whole career on that, on being a little bit of a maverick, going away from Hollywood when I could, battling the institutions that I felt no longer were serving the purpose or affecting my art, and being who he is and just knowing who he is and being okay with it and understanding there's slings and arrows. Don't worry. And I'm sure there's probably a day he's been in that office, that nice wood office of Skywalker Ranch, going, man, that sucks. You know, I'm sure he'd love to be loved all unilaterally, but he knows he can't, and he knows he's going to tell his stories. It's powerful.
Yeah, yeah, no, and I'm sure that he takes pain and umbrage, and you know, any creator knows if you have like a place where people are going to review you online and you get 49 positive comments and one negative one, which one are you going to think about? It's a struggle to not think about the negative ones, and clearly Lucas had some quotes where he has been, you know, affected by the amount of criticism, and it has upset him and made him mad. You know, he's human. But yeah, I think exactly what you're saying. I think like this being in the book is also just a history lesson, maybe, as you were saying at the top of this podcast, for people who didn't live through some of this. You know, I have a bit in my stand-up when I talk about Star Wars where I got a tweet once from somebody who didn't like the sequel trilogy, which is fine, saying, I wish it was like Star Wars was like when George Lucas was still in charge and everybody agreed about everything. And that person probably just had the life experience that they didn't know this real life history. And that I think is important as well.
Absolutely. 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 Indeed.
The Star Wars wars are not new.
They're not new. Going back to 77. And this one, so about 97, this shirt was probably made, right? Is that what you said? So it's probably the re-release?
Yeah. Or, so it's, you know, somebody from the New Yorker going 20 years later and we're still celebrating this. And like, just that great tension too of just a critic who's like, I've been certain for 20 years that this thing is horrible. And yet it has changed all of society around me.
I'm not naming names. There's a couple people I know I've worked with, have been around answering trivia questions who have that, like, this is a horrible franchise. They're all bad movies and Fast and Furious is better. And I'm like, you know, from your perspective, that's not wrong for you, but look around you.
Yes. We have an entirely altered society that disagrees. Yeah.
So that's a great way to start the list, man. It's going to be a fun discussion here. We're going to go to my number five. And I did the opposite of Joseph. I wrote down page numbers. I failed to take pictures, which probably would have been better. But you're going to hear me flipping through the pages. This one is The Rhythm of Rey and Ren. The key new themes composed by John Williams for The Force Awakens were those for Rey and Kylo Ren. John Williams says, Rey for me was particularly difficult, Williams said. It's kind of an adventure theme in a way. She's a girl who's been a scavenger, who's been alone. She's without her parents. I felt a lot of empathy for this poor creature who's at once brilliant and can defend herself. But you want to touch something in her that's vulnerable and recognizes her need. For Kylo, Williams deliberately evoked his work with Darth Vader. Williams said, if it can convey in a few short notes the way the Imperial March does evil power, it will need to be something that will hit you and is accessible right away. So I love those ones because I was one of the ones in the early days, like we're talking days or weeks when you're jumping on podcasts too soon before you've had time to think about the movie you just watched. Where I was like, I don't know. I love the movie. I don't know. None of the themes stood out to me. If I could go back in time, I'd take a Nerf bat and hit myself right now. Again, you got to take time. Things hit you differently. The Rogue One soundtrack and score did that for me too. Hit me a little bit later on, but there's some beautiful pieces in that I just wasn't paying attention to. And Rey's theme and Kylo's theme have emerged for me as two of my favorite just pieces. The musical cue he's talking about with Kylo is so effective in Force Awakens. You could remove the dialogue and just hear the music, and that's going to convey everything you need to know. But the Rey one specifically, I go back to those early moments in Force Awakens on Jakku. It's still some of my favorite stuff. I just watched all three of these films last week, and it's still some of my favorite stuff in the modern era. Rey on Jakku, getting to know her, getting to get behind her, some save the cat moments with BB-8 and everything. You feel for her in a lot of ways, and it's so hopeful. And to then watch that theme again come back to in play during Rise of Skywalker. What I call the heavy metal version a little bit when she's fighting and Palpatine and all that kind of stuff. Where it even ends in Tatooine. It just really drove home that I love this theme. It's some of Williams' best work, and he was really inspired by this character. And to hear this quote, it really just, number one, the casual genius of Williams. Like, I needed to try to figure this out. And you did. So I love everything about it. And it says, his description here of Rey is why I continue to just go back to that character and pull inspiration from myself and just find inspiration in that story. Just at once brilliant and can defend herself, but also vulnerable and has a big giant need. And I think that really does start with the music. So that's why I love that fact.
Yeah, no, that is a great fact and a great one to pull out. I feel weird, like, oh no, I'm repeating myself. But my wife and I just recorded a podcast last night about soundtracks.
Right.
Because my wife really loves soundtracks, and this came up specifically Rey's theme. I remember just being hit like a ton of bricks by Rey's theme in the first viewing, because sometimes I'm somebody who I just get so invested in the characters and the thematic ideas and the story structure. And I have lots of different lenses that I'm looking at a movie through. So sometimes the music doesn't hit me on the first viewing. And there was something so powerful for me about Rey's theme that it hit me. Absolutely. Is this like, wow, that is totally Star Wars. That is totally John Williams. And yet I've never heard anything quite like it in Star Wars that evokes that exact emotion of there's something both incredibly strong and incredibly fragile about it. That like, it feels like it is hopeful. Like it is monotonous, but it is about to explode. Like, and it reflects her life. I'm not criticizing the music is monotonous in any way, but it's just got that, like, it's trying to explode, you know? And it absolutely does in Rise of Skywalker and all of those great permutations of Rey's theme that really celebrate the growth. And then I think Kylo's theme is under discussed too, because I think it is very effective of he is the bad guy, but there's also something kind of perfectly incomplete and reaching for being as complete as something like the Imperial March, and it's not.
And again, Rise of Skywalker, I love some of that stuff in the end. And I'm no David Collins, who does excellent soundtrack and score breakdowns. Check out his stuff if you've never done it. But, you know, to see where he takes the Kylo theme and as it becomes kind of Ben's theme and just the notes that come in and how it works with the Rey's theme in that final battle. It's just, it's great stuff. And we are just so fortunate. As George will tell you, it's John Williams is the secret sauce, and he'll say that to the end of time. And you're right. When you're sitting watching a movie, the music's usually the last thing I pay attention to. So I'm not surprised at myself for coming out of the first view and going, I don't know, I didn't hear any themes. I'm looking at so many other things, but that's why we encourage you to just really engage with what's presented and invest and go back and let things sit for a bit. Cause this eventually grabs me as just one of my favorites.
Yeah. Great pick.
Great pick. Well, thank you, sir. You've got a great pick coming up here. Number four.
My number four is The Thing from Another Ice World. That's what it's called. Here's what Pablo Hidalgo wrote. Renowned screenwriter and sci-fi fantasy author Lee Brackett joined George Lucas for early development of The Empire Strikes Back script. She had written screenplays for director Howard Hawks, including the classic 1951 sci-fi movie The Thing from Another World, which would be remade by John Carpenter as The Thing in 1982. Lucas cited the original film in the terror of a beast that had infiltrated an icy base during early creative meetings for The Empire Strikes Back. I like this one for lots of reasons. One of them is just how much pop culture is intertwined with itself in this fun way. That was a fact that I'd never heard, that Lucas was inspired by the original Thing from Another World when visualizing how you could have terror on an icy world in a base, which makes perfect sense. The history of the Thing from Another World in pop culture is just kind of fascinating, since the characters in Halloween, on the night Halloween, are watching the Thing from Another World. And then apparently, I guess John Carpenter watched his own movie and was like, you know what? I should make that movie that's within my movie. And that's all that history then I see within The Empire Strikes Back. So that was one reason that this one jumped out to me. But the other one is just, I feel like Lucas hiring Lee Brackett is something that has always stuck with me about the I know a lot of her stuff did not necessarily make it to the final draft, but just the involvement of someone from that era that Lucas, you know, when he's making Empire Strikes Back and knew that he was not going to do everything by himself and went out and hired people and was like, okay, I'll hire, you know, my old mentor, Irvin Kershner, as the director, who I'm going to hire as a writer. Well, Lucas says to himself, I would imagine, Star Wars is pulling from all of these other genres. Why don't I hire someone who wrote them? She was a screenwriter on The Big Sleep, great Western Rio Bravo, a later Raymond Chandler adaptation, The Long Goodbye, you know, as well as things like Thing from Another World, as well as just being an author herself of novels. And just the idea that it's not just the ideas of those other eras and those other genres that Lucas was interested in. He was like older woman in Hollywood who was responsible for these things and probably doesn't get enough credit for them. Come play.
Yeah.
That's really cool to me.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. She passed away, of course, during the writing process. I'm looking it up just to confirm of age 62. Well said. I'm sorry if I'm cutting you off. I got more points. I love this indicates so much of just Lucas knowing, again, we talked about knowing what he is as the artist and knowing what he's trying to accomplish and knowing the influences. And I always say it, in interviews, I'm paraphrasing, but just like, I'm taking all these things and doing my version of them in a way, because I feel that's valuable, because I want generations to experience it. And he wants you to go back and review the other stuff. And so it's pretty powerful. And then, you're right. A 62-year-old woman with seemingly most of her accomplishments in the past, that's a powerful choice and a very clear choice that Lucas was making there. And I respect him for that as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And I just, it's a thing that is close to my heart, as listeners of Force Center know, that Star Wars is very much tied to all of these roots of the truly pulpy. And, you know, I think when you see bits of Lee Brackett's script, it's really tied to those roots. It just is those roots in some ways. And I always like celebrating that.
Yeah. And look, and as far as her, her passing away during the process, and Lawrence Kasdan comes in and does amazing work. And we love Kasdan's contributions to Star Wars indeed. But I sometimes, some of these big concepts that she introduced, and some of you read some of the stuff in her story, early Empire story, and they're kind of crazy, right? They're kind of big. They're kind of big sci-fi stuff. I sometimes just wonder if she had been allowed to continue and go through the process, and what would he, I'm not saying I want that version of Empire. I'm so happy with what we have, but you know what I mean? Like it's a little almost tragic. That's like some of the big concepts that couldn't be developed as the process went along.
Yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely. Indeed. Great. Number four there from you, sir. So we're going to my number four, which is, as I flip to the page 28, for those keeping score at home, pre-shooting the prequels. This was maybe a little outside the box choice for me here, but here we go. In the case of The Phantom Menace, the filmmakers greatly relied on the utility of animatics, a sort of low-resolution placeholder version of computer animation and quickly assembled video photography to pre-visualized scenes as a movie was being conceived. These were vital, as upwards of 70% of the film would require visual effects work, and decisions need to be made early to focus that work as effectively as possible. Co-editor Ben Burtt and animatic supervisor David Dozeretz essentially pre-shot the movie with crude temporary CG graphics and footage of crew members standing in as characters. This version of Episode One was then replaced bit by bit in editorial as finished shots came in. All right, where can I get that version?
I was just going to say, if they have the entire film just made like a weird, fun, you know, goof trailer, I would love that.
Yeah. And you know, in the Phantom Menace doc, The Beginning, which we talk about a lot here, we do love, there's a couple of like the early test shots with Jar Jar on the back of a pickup truck. I'm fascinated by that. I am fascinated as a kid of reading that they pre-shot the speeder bike chase with figures. The ones I owned, they used the figures I owned, and the trees were cardboard, like paper towel tubes. Great. And I just was blown away by that. So I'm still, even now in my advancing age here in 2020, which is obsessed with this kind of the process it takes to make these movies and shows. And you see even going up to The Mandalorian or The Volume and what they're able to do with previs stuff and animatics and just really make a lot of decisions before you even get to set. It's invaluable. And that speaks to the legacy of the prequels, part of it, and more on that in a bit. And also, Ben Burtt, hey man, this guy, we owe him a lot as Star Wars fans. And I think everyone knows that, but it continues. Sound effects, sure. Editing, he edited the prequels, or co-editor, you know, as it's listed. And then was out there shooting these animatics to help with the editing process. He's done quite a bit and appeared in the movies, as we know.
Yes, that is right. Colonel Dyer. Yeah, no, I always, when this comes up, I'm always just like, yeah, Ben Burtt playing action figures. That's how he made some of Star Wars happen, you know, not just the great contribution for, you know, all those sounds we kind of like, but, you know, also just getting down in there and playing. If you like this fact, I really have to recommend this film called Making Waves, The Art of Cinematic Sound. It's a documentary that came out in 2019. It was playing at the Arclight Hollywood, bless its soul. And it is a history of the advancements in sound technology and sound design. And there's a lot of fascinating facts, both Star Wars related and not even remotely Star Wars related. But it's got a lot of great interviews with Ben Burtt about his whole career and his journey. And it was in that film that I learned that Ben Burtt, as a younger person before he met George Lucas, had made his own short film that is a spoof of Flash Gordon and Buck Rogers. And his film from 1973 is called Rod Flash Conquers Infinity. And when you see that, and you know, it's definitely the design thing. But when I saw that, like, oh, wow, Lucas and Ben Burtt were like just two peas who are not yet in the same pod, and they needed to be in a pod together. Yeah. And that pod is Star Wars now. But it made sense to me from this sound design, but it also just made sense to me of like, yeah, a young filmmaker who wants to make a spoof in 1973 before anybody gives a damn about any of this stuff called Rod Flash Conquers Infinity. Hell yeah, he wants to get out some action figures and make a fun animatic. He's making a little short film, right?
That's amazing. I've never heard that. And you've mentioned this doc before. I got to track it down streaming somewhere. This is right up my alley of just docs I love to watch. Come on. Can we get a go picture on that right now?
Yeah, no. I mean, I don't know. They show a clip of it in the documentary. But yeah, Making Waves, The Art of Cinematic Sound. Find it. It is on streaming. I don't remember where, but it's great. And so is this fact.
Yeah, the behind the scenes stuff. Powerful, powerful, powerful indeed. All right, that is my number four, which just means we're up to your number three.
My number three is A.K.A. Rey. Here is what is written. The Force Awakens' long journey from idea to a finished film was filled with evolution, but one idea that remained constant from the start was that of a young woman's quest to become a Jedi Knight. In George Lucas's original outline, she was a 14-year-old girl named Taryn. In his subsequent iterations, she would briefly be named Thea, and believe it or not, Winky. When writer-director J.J. Abrams came aboard, he simplified the names to placeholders. Kylo Ren was the Jedi Killer. Thea became Sally. Finn was called Harry. And the character that would become Poe was John Doe. As the film neared production, Sally became Kira, which stuck as a production code name, then Echo, and finally Rey. Wow. There are a lot of facts in that one fact, Ken.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think my big thing for this is like all the name stuff is utterly fascinating. Some of it is really well known, like the Kira thing. Right. I think I heard Echo at one point, but that's fascinating. Now that we got Bad Batch and we're really spending quality time with a different Echo. There's an interesting part of this book that comes out a couple different places of talking about what is in Lucas's original outlines. And just teasing that beautiful someday where where we'll get to see the whole outlines and the internet will explode. What was interesting to me about this discussion of it, though, is that there were iterations. Because it says specifically in George Lucas's original outline, then in his subsequent iterations, which sounds like they have in the archives George's drafts of the outlines, which means that sometimes we have these conversations about here's what was in George's outline, here's what it was going to be or whatever. There might have been three or four different ideas. And then the other thing for me is just, again, obviously, we all know the history that a lot of things got changed, that Lucas himself expressed some displeasure with some of the ideas not being used in The Force Awakens in particular. We all know that history. But for me, I really like it when we're reminded that there are ideas that are a constant through every version of the sequel trilogy, including that it's focused on a young woman who is destined to become a Jedi.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. There's some of those through lines without a doubt, the internet would turn anything into a competition. I understand that, but when some of the stuff started emerging, I felt comforted. Does that make sense, Joseph? Just like, yeah. Yeah, yeah. No, I believe me. I want to read every word of what George might have done in 7, 8, 9. Absolutely. And there's going to be moments where you're like, oh, I'd like that more. I don't like that as much. Or what are these really weird microbiotic characters? What is this? Yeah, totally. But there was some great, I don't know. Yeah, just comfort of just like, yeah, the core is there. The wavelength was the same in some areas, and even though there's some big changes and stuff around it. And, you know, we'll never know. That's the thing we all live with. But, I for one, am here for the adventures of Winky.
That's right. I'm glad that we got to hear the story of Winky. And who knows, that Rey could have taken that as her last name instead of Skywalker, and that would have really had a huge reaction from the audience.
It just, right. It's really, if it's from George, you know, and it's like an early version, and if he's like Winky, and this is the same guy who gave us Wormy, like.
Yeah, so I found that one really, really fascinating. Also, just the like the reminder of like, you know, we do have the outlines.
I know.
Right. We're not releasing them right now and probably not for a while, which is probably for the best.
Yes, I'm good. If someone in a trench coat and a fedora and a mask wants to slip me the outlines in a parking garage in Burbank, I'll take them. But I'm good. That's a great number three. My number three is actually one I touched upon in a Spotlight Star Wars not too long ago, almost on the fly. Literally, as I was recording, was thumbing through this book because it was near my my studio setup here, and it's just like, I love this little fact. So we're gonna dive into it a little bit more here. Page 79, a new Vader vantage point. George Lucas said part of his goal with the creation of the prequel trilogy was to change the audience perspective of Darth Vader in the first trilogy. In 4, people didn't know whether Vader was a robot or a monster, or if there was anybody in there. This way, when you see him walk into the spaceship in episode 4, you're going to say, oh my God, that's Anakin. The poor guy is still stuck in his suit. So the tension and drama is completely reversed. I think it's pretty self-explanatory, but I love that. I have become obsessed because of, I think, in my my own maturation of as a Star Wars fan, or just seeing things a little different than I used to. Of just like, I was one who watched Revenge of the Sith and was just like, man, I like it. I don't know. I wish Anakin's change was pretty weak. I don't get it. He says Padme, and I was one of the ones that George was probably speaking to. Of just like, hey, glad you love the original trilogy. This was the story I was trying to tell. Going back to our original point of your first point, your first fact, Joseph, just like, he knows what he wants to do. He knows what he wants to do, feels what he wants to tell. And that sentence made no sense, but we're going to roll with it. And I love that George is like, look, I want to change your perspectives, because it's 1 through 6 at the time. And this is the story of this man's fall and his son and daughter around him and everything about it. And what puts you into that suit and the tragedy of him still being there. And I always go to a friend of mine who his wife just did not grow up with Star Wars at all. Grew up in another country, which of course doesn't mean anything. Star Wars is everywhere, but it just was not part of her daily culture, mm-hmm. not part of her youth. And they watched 1 through 6. And when Anakin fell in Revenge of the Sith, he said, dude, she was bawling that little Annie fell. And I never have moved off that conversation. I think about that often. And I think about that when I read this stuff of George going, man, y'all worshiped this dude. Y'all thought he was so cool and so powerful. That's not what I was trying to do. That's not. And so I need to make sure I go back and kind of reframe it. And I think this point drives that home. And it was very intentional from George.
Yeah, this is a great fact, and I think a really important one to highlight. I think there's absolutely nothing wrong of enjoying Vader as a villain, right?
And oh, yeah.
Even
yeah.
Enjoying the thrill of a villain with great power, unstoppable. Like, there's a reason we like to tell stories about people who have fallen to the dark side, because it's a safe way to explore that, right? But then there is that crossing from having the safe exploration of horror and evil to going, well, actually, he's right. And I wish I was him is, you know, I think, or just really thinking it's cool that he kills people with absolutely no other examination of it, you know? And I think that seems to be like, that's the part of it that Lucas is pushing back on. And one of my favorite shots, Revenge of the Sith, the prequels, Star Wars period, is, Anakin being put into the suit, and those great perspective shots and the amazing acting job in that moment of Hayden Christensen, that look on his face, he's being put in prison. Yeah. He is being put in prison after causing horrific amounts of pain and getting nothing for it. Yeah. That is very clearly the story of Vader. And that doesn't mean that we can't enjoy him as a, you know, is a villain and is a pop culture sensation and can't enjoy the thrill of his action. But when you engage on it of what's the story, what's the morality, man, your friend's partner is right to weep.
Yeah, indeed. And look, you and I love the Rogue One hallway scene for many reasons. And some of it is, man, Vader going full Vader. And we used to talk about it on the playground for years. And so to see that, but also the horror of it and sacrifice of the rebels, there's so much there, as it always should be in scenes. But I'm with you. That was a powerful moment, and it's a powerful purpose. It makes that redemption, Return of the Jedi. My friend's wife, I don't know. I have to ask the reaction of Return of the Jedi. Weeping tears of joy of the redemption. So, yeah.
Yeah. One hopes. Yeah. And the last thing I'll say on it, because you really touched on it, is totally open to criticisms of any Star Wars and the prequels. And I certainly still have mine like, oh, what about this? What about that? But the more time I spend with the prequels, George, you can dislike the choices that he made, but he made choices and he knows why, you know?
Mm-hmm. And he'll wear it on a t-shirt if you don't get it. So that is my number three. We're up to your number two. We're ranking our favorite Star Wars fascinating facts from Pablo Hidalgo's book. Joseph, what you got for number two?
Number two, we've talked about some deep things, Ken. We're going to Silly Town. This one is titled Silly Names for Fearsome Creatures. Pablo writes, most of the creatures lurking in the background of Jabba's palace would never have their names spoken aloud, but they all had some sort of moniker. Some of these would be exposed to Star Wars fans through action figures or trading cards, often revealing the playful or punch-drunk nature of the overworked ILM creature shop when they named these oddballs. Salacious B. Crumb's name started off from a misspoken utterance of shoelaces as Sulacious. Ifant Mon takes clear inspiration from Elephant Man. The mole-like Elam just needs to look at his name in the mirror to find the source of his handle. Rees was three eyes. In Hermy Odal's silly name, Hear Me Yodel, is an improvement over his first name, Hemi Moroid. I enjoyed this whole thing for many reasons. You know, that truth that you and I talk about because of the generation we grew up in of how much of our knowledge and attachment to Star Wars is through living and reliving the story again and again through action figures and trading cards. That's really fun to have that, you know, expressly reflected as a truth. that is the experience of our generation of fans. Some of these things I knew about where the actual names came from. And I love Hermy Odal. He has come to be one of my favorite characters because he's just if you're not familiar with Hermy Odal, give him a Google and just marvel at what is going on with his appearance and most importantly, his tongue. I didn't know that his name came from Hear Me Yodel. Maybe that's what's going on with his tongue. And yeah, I just love the contrast between, frankly, people like us who have the action figures, mm-hmm. trading cards, still, you know, frustrated when a very minor character, background character doesn't have a name. And, you know, it's so well documented who these characters are. And we fight in trivia contests over it. And then to just think, like, as Pablo Hidalgo writes, playful or punch-drunk people are just like, we need a bunch of creatures. What's this one's name? Hear Me Yodel? Great. And the contrast between the fun and flippant way that these names came about versus, you know, I could win a trivia contest by knowing that.
So right. It's so, I mean, I have read these, this fascinating facts book like a couple times now. And so, but this one still jumps out to me and I laugh because like, I love Salacious B. Crumb and I'm one of those like, no, you got to include the B. That's key, but it's basically untied shoelaces. It might be it like, you know, hey, Joe Johnston, your shoelaces are untied. My what? You're shoelacious. Oh, get a character. Like who knows? And you're so right. And here we are years later. If you know, you got to get it right. You got to get it right. And both sides are fun. Both sides draw me into Star Wars. And this is one of the things I love about this book, just highlighting the, like you said, the punch drunk nature of these guys in a creature shop running deadlines before Uncle George comes by to tell them yay or nay.
Just exhausted going, I don't know. What's this one's name? That's so much fun.
It's a great needle to my, if I ever sometimes get that my balloon of Star Wars fandom pumps up a little too much on the pretentious side, this stuff like this really is just a needle poke in that.
Just, yeah.
Don't forget. Don't forget, man.
It is. Yeah. And it is just such a reminder of just like, you know, on some level, you do have to accept the tension of Star Wars, that it's everything from what we were just talking about of this mythic journey of this, you know, tragic badass Vader. And then it is also hear me yodel with his tongue hanging out. It's both. It's, and so far, it's never not going to be both.
We're going five rounds of almost literal boxing over Akbar and Last Jedi. And it's like, we're fighting over an appetizer. It's an appetizer. What are you doing? What are you doing?
Yeah. So that's my number two, The Strange History of Hermiodal.
Love it. Great choice. My number two here. Then we'll take a quick break and have some runners ups and our number ones here. But going to page 55. This is Digital Cinema Revolution. For Star Wars Episode II, Attack of the Clones, George Lucas and producer Rick McCallum worked with Sony for 6 years to design the perfect cameras, the HDW F924P, to shoot this movie. The partnership included Panavision, which would develop lenses for the camera to meet the needs of cinematographers. The entire project was shot, processed, edited, and even distributed by satellite download and projected digitally in some markets. When Episode 1 opened, there were four digital screens. Four. When Episode 2 opened on May 16, 2002, about 100 of its 3,161 theaters had digital screens. Now that number of digital screens available tops 38,000. Those are impressive numbers both ways of just how small it was. And I remember my eighth and final viewing of The Phantom Menace was a digital print or what I went
to
theaters with NECA. And it was so clear, I almost didn't like it. You know, it's like, I don't know.
Where's the flickering?
I see the seams on Jar Jar, you know, which was impossible as a digital character. Anyways, this quote, this fact, I should say, it drives home what we've talked about a lot. And even here today with George, knowing who he is as a storyteller and who he is as a filmmaker, but who he is as someone who is not just interested in stuff, but finds it important to move filmmaking forward. Does this fact erase any sins of Attack of the Clones for you if you hold on to them? Maybe not, but it is tremendously valuable to me as a fan to know that this is also part of the legacy of Star Wars. We just talked about the creature shop at ILM. ILM comes about because George is like, well, I guess we need to do this ourselves. Let's make a creature, a visual effects company. Let's do this. And Jar Jar and all credit due to Andy Serkis and Peter Jackson and the stuff they pulled off in those movies. But let's not forget Ahmed Best. Let's not forget to throw some respect on Ahmed Best for being the first fully realized kind of digital character. I love this stuff about the prequels. I love hearing that for 6 years in the 90s for a movie released in 2002, they're like, we're going to need something that we don't have right now. Can we make it? Because we want to get there. And to see where they go with the volume, no wonder George shows up to set.
It's got that clip of like, yeah, we were close to this. We were trying to figure something like this out. Yeah.
Yeah. Kathleen Kennedy saying too, like, well, George wanted this. He at the end of the street in Skywalker Ranch, he was going to build it. Love it. It's part of his legacy. It's what gets him excited. He's a car guy. Don't forget, you know, he's not like a classic gearhead, I guess, in that kind of sense. And even if he is, great. But you know, like, car guy, tinkering, building, thinking Anakin, thinking Luke, building stuff. This makes perfect sense. Let's build a better way to make a film, make it more cost effective, all those kind of things. I'm fascinated by it, and you could write books on it. These are numbers and things that are sometimes over my head. I'm here for the pew, pew, pew most of the time, but I love it, Joseph. It's part of the legacy of Star Wars, but specifically the prequels.
Yeah, no, I'm really glad you picked this fact. And when they say that it took 6 years to make that camera and then you read the name of it, I was like, how many years was just coming up with that name? How many letters down the line? Yeah, this is also just like Star Wars as lived history becoming Star Wars as recorded history. I don't know if you had the same experience. I think it was because I was paying a lot of attention to the buildup to Attack of the Clones. I was really excited for it. I was writing a lot and therefore procrastinating on the internet. the coming of Attack of the Clones was the true birth of internet procrastination for me personally. But I remember that just being everywhere, a point of discussion everywhere, that Attack of the Clones is going to be all digital. And most of it, I remember being kind of like, Lucas doesn't understand the romance of practical effects. He doesn't understand the right. romance of film stock. He's going to ruin everything. Here we go. You know, that's right. That's what I remember being the conversation being. But I remember it being a big deal. And I wonder if that's an experience I had, or how many people, you know, younger generations, like that's kind of a new fact to.
Yeah, no, that's a great point. I'm trying to transport myself back to that day, and look, this is something that we all could struggle with. Change can be difficult, and change can be hard. But like, holding on to the old ways is a dangerous form of attachment, and it doesn't mean we kill the past. It means we learn from it, improve it, and there's definitely great things to pull forward. And I do remember those conversations of the magic of filmmaking and even in film and what it looks like. And those are all, you know, discussions to have. But yeah, there was some like, George, what are you doing kind of thoughts.
Yeah, absolutely. Everything's just going to be made in a computer. Nothing is ever going to have any soul. And I know there's still debates to be had about, you know, you can tell sometimes when, wow, that human jumped off a cliff in a James Bond movie from the 70s, and that person could have died.
Right.
And is that different than absolutely knowing? They pasted Mark Ruffalo's head on that. You know, like, you know, there's those discussions to be had. That's all fine and good. But yeah, I mean, really relating Lucas's constant desire to push technology forward to the themes that are in Star Wars about, you know, change is natural. Change has to happen. Change does not necessarily mean entirely erasing the past. It means that being able to let go and evolve. And to see, you know, this direct line from Attack of the Clones, being the first all digital, which took a lot of heat and a lot of umbrage, all the way back, all the way to the volume where it's kind of reached this stage of like, great, now we can utilize this marriage of the digital in the real to make things feel more real for the actor. And now it's almost come like full circle where the digital possibilities are now reconnecting people back to feeling grounded in the filmmaking they're doing, because it's real photography and it's on the screen and I can see it.
Yeah. I'm listening to you talk there, Joseph, and I'm thinking like, I still occasionally get grumpy about the volume. I do. You know, there's some parts of Mandalorian I'm like, I don't know. I wish they were filming up in the Redwood City. Like, and it's a challenge for me. But I've always, you know, been respectful of what they're pulling off and to hear actors talk. I mean, Ewan McGregor can't stop talking about it. Right.
Right.
And there's this cool thing they're filming. We know you, and we know, but it's so awesome. Carl Weathers just say it so perfect of like, we as actors make our choices, but it's all there in front of us. And we all can sync up our choices in a way. I'm paraphrasing, of course. Yeah. Fascinated by it. It's part of the history. Just well said on a lot of that stuff there. And yeah, you're really transported me, Joseph, back to the heady days of 2000, 2001 and 2002.
Yeah.
George is doing, again, he's going to replace actors. There's going to be no actors anymore.
Everyone's going to be a Jar Jar.
Yeah. 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 Well, I remember even you got Ben Burtt. God bless Burtt. Poking fun at him at all, but like talking about that they go through him editing that scene in the cockpit where it's like what Qui-Gon and Panaka and Rick Olier and Obi-Wan and taking literal parts from other scenes and putting it, and how Bert's like, I don't know, we're playing God in the computer. Like, I don't know. So
great yeah, stuff. Good stuff. Great pick.
Thank you, sir. Thank you, sir. That is my number two. And what we're going to do here is take a quick break on the other side. Some runner-ups. We're not going to read all of them. We're just going to go through what we got. And then our number one choices of our favorite fascinating facts in this fun book by Pablo Madonna. Stick around here for more Star Wars Ranked.
This podcast is brought to you by eHarmony, the dating app to find someone you can be yourself with. Why doesn't eHarmony allow copy and paste in first messages? Because you are unique, and your conversations should reflect that. eHarmony wants you to find someone who will get you. How are you going to know who gets you? If people send you the same generic conversation starters, they message everyone else. Conversations that actually help you get to know each other. Imagine that. Get who gets you on eHarmony. Sign up today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Hey, 4Center friends, make sure you're keeping up to date on all the great content from Jennifer Landa. Whether it's YouTube, Instagram, or TikTok, you whippersnappers, 4Center's own Jennifer Landa continues to bring you fun, informative, and insightful laughs and moments.
Also, Jennifer brings her experience and perspective as a Star Wars-loving mother to her DIY projects, blogs, and more. So be sure to head on over to JennyLanda.com, that's JennyLanda.com, for articles like how to make your own Darth Maul sneakers or 10 unique Star Wars baby gift ideas.
Follow Jen on Twitter and Instagram at Jennifer Landa and on TikTok as JenniferLanda1138.
And we're back here on Star Wars Rank. Joseph Scrimshaw and myself are ranking our favorite facts from Star Wars. Fascinating facts, story, lore, and history from the greatest galaxy by Pablo Hidalgo. We are having a lot of fun, there's a lot of different facts, a lot of great timelines for characters. I love Joseph, like you even said off air, we're kind of pulling a lot of George stuff here. hey, throw some respect on that flannel guy.
Exactly. You know, it's there to be pulled from the book.
Yeah. We've got some runner-ups here, some facts that are great, but didn't quite make our top five here. Joseph, what are a couple from you?
Yeah, a couple from me. This one is maybe one that you were like, yeah, of course, Joseph, but this is one that I hadn't known. This is called Ernie the Greater, and it talks about how a human named Ernie Fossilius, who was the... Fosilius was the creator of Hardware Wars, also played Malakili, and did the voice for Poggle the Lesser. When I read this one, I was like one of those memes where you go like, that's amazing. That's amazing. And then boom, Galaxy Brain.
Yeah.
The fact that that was all connected. I did not know that fact and did a great one.
Yeah. It's Hardware Wars. He's the guy who gave us Hardware Wars. And that's a big part of my life. And the Poggle the Lesser one, I'm glad you brought that up because I did a Spotlight Star Wars or I did a Star Wars Ranked actually by myself on Hardware Wars. I talked about Ernie Fosilius. I say his name different every time. He's wonderfully cranky. He's wonderfully grumpy. He's a very interesting guy. I couldn't find confirmation on the Poggle fact. It was like on Wikipedia, but not here there. And then I forgot about this book where Pablo's like, yeah, that was him. It's a great fact.
Amazing. And I'm not misreading this. He's Malakili.
Yes. Yeah. He's the voice of, I think he's the cry.
Oh, okay. Yes. Yeah, okay.
He's a taller, thinner dude.
But that makes sense. Yes. Bert cast Fosilius as the sobbing Rancor Keeper. So he came in and did some crying.
Great stuff. Again, you know, Hardware Wars, George loves it. It's a Lifetime Achievement Award fan film, though. Ernie says it's not a fan film. I do parodies. So Last Jedi, side note, sorry, you're getting me. Last Jedi, when Rian Johnson throws that homage to Hardware Wars with the iron and everything. Ernie was not happy about it. He had this weird rant in an article of like, I'm selling tickets for that movie with my thing. He's an interesting kind of curmudgeonly cat and you should all check it out.
That's so great.
Yeah. Great stuff.
Yeah. So a couple more from me. This one just made me laugh. It's a discussion of BB-9E and basically it's called an evil BB, but just that before he had before the droid had a proper name, that the crew called him BB Hate, which cracked me up. Then the Muppet connection, which is just a fun little story about how Mark Hamill wanted Frank Oz on set. He asked him to perform and hear the Miss Piggy voice, to which Frank Oz said no, and then eventually surprised Mark Hamill on set one day by the Yoda puppet went down and the Miss Piggy puppet came up. And it's just a very funny, great story of these two great, great contributions to Star Wars from Mark Hamill and Frank Oz and them in the fandom between them.
Love that one. Couple for me here. I love the sunken Death Star. This is one of those ones that, yeah, it's probably well known. You get the Art of book for Force Awakens and you got a character that we kind of now acknowledge as Rey swimming around the remains of the Death Star underwater, including the Falcon going there. And it was really intriguing. I remember getting that Art of book and being like, wow, look at that. And for JJ to come back and get the chance to do 9 after he thought he wasn't. And then to revisit that just also speaks to the filmmaking process and a lot of the stuff with Macquarie, you know, that concept Macquarie put out, we never used it, but now it's Lothal or, you know, along with Phil Tippett, some of those things. I love that about Star Wars. I love that just about the filmmaking and storytelling process. So that was one of my favorite ones there.
Yeah, I really like that, too, because it is just a reminder that, you know, as fans, we can kind of get caught up on like timelines and where is a person going to show up and, you know, where are they going to decide to include this character? And just a reminder that storytelling, even with big budget things like this, is just kind of at the gut level sometimes, too. If there's clearly something to that image of sunken evil that just spoke to J.J. Abrams, right? He just want that image on the screen because it affects me, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, well done. Yes, sunken evil indeed. I love this one, Junking a Junk Planet Connection, because we do, especially back in 2014, 2015. It wasn't unfair for any of us to think that Star Wars was going to be connected. And we still think it is in various ways, the emotional canon, that phrase we love around here. But we were looking for the general clues. And Star Wars Rebels was the first out of the gate. And so we all were looking for, is Zare Leonis? Is that Finn? Is that Finn's father? We are all looking for those connections. And I get it. But the Junking the Planet one talks about how Force Awakens and Rebels were both in concurrent development. And there was a junk planet going to be in episode 7. So maybe they thought maybe that would start out in Rebels, not a junk planet, but an Imperial kind of run planet. And it just production timelines, shifting schedules and development, the needs of animations versus live action all factored into them junking that junk connection. And so Lothal and Jakku developed separately and were separate planets. So I'm glad it's the way it is. But that would have been fun. Would have been interesting. But it also would have spawned an entire subgenre of everything is everything, which is less fun for me.
Yeah, I mean, when you're resharing that fact, what I am hearing is the sound of 1,000 clickbait articles and fan theories that could have been, right? I mean,
yeah.
Everyone would have been convinced that Ezra is Rey's, you know, granduncle or whatever, you know?
Yeah, 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 yeah. Hey, look, and I was up for a good Rey theory. I love that time. But then I just remember one point, it was around the Battlefront 2. Aiden and Del Mico as Rey's parents, where I went like, no, that's not, that can't be it. That's not it. What am I doing? So, God bless if you do. Love that one there. Another one for me was Star Wars on the Radio. This is talking about the Star Wars radio plays that Lucas, you know, kind of gave the license to NPR and here we go. And a lot of people, and Pablo's talked about it. He's a big fan of these because he talks about them a lot. Particularly Perry King is Han Solo. He's like, for a lot of people, that was their Han Solo. A lot of Brock Peters is Darth Vader and Saxon Leia. Hamill and Anthony Daniels reprise their roles there, written by Brian Daley, directed by John Madden. They're great. But this little thing, Joseph, this line, 13 episode audio only version that expands the action of the film to over 6 hours and adds new scenes and characters. Could you imagine, talk about clickbait articles? We get the novelizations and an extra chapter or deleted scene shows up, and that turns into YouTube essays about what could have been or what should have been. Imagine, here's a completely authorized radio version that has different things in it and different characters. Where are they? Don't worry, they're on the radio.
Is NPR canon? Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I remember listening to these and then I haven't listened forever because my copies are on cassette.
Oh, wow.
But I very much remember, and there's a lot of stuff, a lot of really fascinating stuff. And then, you know, listening also as a kid and having such a relationship to Star Wars as a visual thing, being fascinated by how they would tell visual parts of the story, you know. But yeah, man, it would be that would be a great project to do. Like, yeah, we're gonna do the prequels and the sequels is you know, like this, and it's not canon, it's another interpretation, you know. Amazing.
Yeah, another version. Hey, and as everyone knows, I'm a big Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy fan, and Douglas Adams always said anytime my story's told, it should be told differently, it should be a different version,
and he lived up to that with Hitchhikers.
Lived up to it indeed. A couple more for you here on the runner up.
Yeah. Endor Wildlife. This is discussing how, like, yep, in Return of the Jedi, there are chickens in the Ewok village. Yes. And an iguana crawling. Yes. On Chief Chirpa. And there's, yeah, the chickens. Sure, let's go with it. It's canon. And then I know you probably know this because it is one of your touch points of Star Wars, the Return of the Jedi novelization, but yeah. It says, according to the novelization of Return of the Jedi, the iguana is Chirpa's pet and advisor.
I mean, look, the Chirpa deserves a re-examination as a powerful leader in Star Wars, and as does that iguana.
Absolutely. What wisdom did that iguana share? Was it a Force-sensitive iguana? We'll find out. In the next radio adaptation, because there was one of Return of the Jedi much later.
Yeah.
Anyway, my final runner up is the one that I think got this book on a lot of people's radar, because it's the one that launched many articles. And it is just the simple Luke Skywalker's destiny. It is one of the shortest facts in the book. And it just says, years before The Last Jedi began development, the treatment left behind by George Lucas in 2012 also had Episode 8 be the one wherein Luke Skywalker would die. It's a very short, very specific fact, and it feels like just a reminder of, like, exactly what we were talking about earlier. Many, many things changed from the various outlines of the sequel trilogy, but some didn't. Some of the big pieces, some of the bones didn't change. And I think also just a gentle, different perspective to fans who, if they dislike those choices, just a gentle reminder to them that, well, that was Lucas's choice as well. So if you dislike that choice, every right, but be aware of how thorough the history of this choice is.
Yeah, indeed. And there's the Colonel Kurtzwalker entry a little bit later in the book too, which is similar, just, same kind of vibe with Luke. George had that kind of plan too. And I think you're right. Just a nice, gentle reminder.
Right. Yeah, I think that fact is that the one piece of art that Lucas approved as being a part of consideration is Luke as this a desperate hermit, right?
Yeah. Yeah, indeed. Indeed. Needs to be drawn back from despair.
Ooh, Interesting. Yeah, yeah. So that's it for me.
Great runner-ups. Final quick ones for me. Page 179, there's one, The Dark Times. We refer to it a lot here. I think I refer to it almost daily in my life, too, of just the dark times, the late 80s, where Star Wars was, believe it or not, kind of a thing in the past. And this kind of, that's a very generation-specific kind of experience. But it was very sad. The way Pablo writes this is like movies. And then the newspaper strip, which there was a newspaper strip of stories, that ends in March of 84. Marvel Comics ends in May of 86. Star Wars fan club folded in 87. And then the toy line tried to keep going with Ewoks and droids, but that too fizzled out. It is just like, it's slowly fading away. Star Wars.
This is one of those generational perspective things that informs a lot. I have that last issue of the comic, and I hunted shelves for years. It's one of the reasons that I love Prune Face, because he was one of the last figures I ever found on a shelf. So to go through that perspective of something like Star Wars that seems huge and omnipresent just drifting away, I think that's sometimes why people of our generation will go like, I think that MCU movie was not my favorite, but hey, I saw superheroes on a big screen. It's partially because throughout 80s and 90s, I watched many things I love just go away entirely for an extremely long time. Star Wars, Doctor Who, James Bond, they all just went away. And I learned that's the way of things. If you love it, it will go away. And I think right now we're not in a world where that's happening, but it is still like, hey, maybe not my favorite James Bond movie. I don't care. I saw James Bond. Same thing with Doctor Who and Star Wars.
It's almost a bigger discussion to have, of just especially for you and I and others, that almost syncs up with our birth and adolescence. So these late 80s, it's almost as if, and this was a time of you got to grow up now. And which one hand is, correct. Yeah, grow up, mature. But also now we're in this era of like, well, cool, but you can take this stuff with you.
Yeah, and it could be part of your life and your career and everything. Yeah.
So, but it literally felt like you got to take the Star Wars toys off your shelf because that's done now. That's done.
It was like the world came in as like, why is that still on your bed sheets? I'm taking these.
Take them. It's a great one. And the final one for me, Cause for Celebrations, similar to what I was saying earlier about the prequels and the technical advancements. This is a reminder that because of episode one, that's why we have Star Wars Celebration. They were like, hey, we got to celebrate Star Wars. May or April 30th into May 2nd, 1999, Denver, Colorado. 30,000 fans turned up. Well, 30 fans, maybe. And celebrated Star Wars as they ushered in this new era. And as you and I and others are scrambling for hotels and tickets and everything for Star Wars Celebration 2022, which we cannot wait to be part of, and we will be there. But it's just a reminder. Hey, episode one. That's the reason we're all celebrating.
Yeah, that's a great one.
All right, we have reached our number one choices, our fascinating facts here, and I'll go with my number one so Joseph can close the show with his number one, page 134. This is called A Galactic Toy Box. George Lucas dismisses the notion that licensing and merchandising was always part of his grand plan. It certainly wasn't something anybody predicted, especially us, he says. The first toys didn't come out until a year after the first film came out. And it's grown into this big opportunity, which has helped finance the movies for me. I enjoy toys, and I make the films to stimulate the imaginations of the audience, and especially the young people who see the film. You and I are big toy guys, toy kids from that generation, still love collecting. Even though merchandising and what people want now has changed over the years, and it's definitely different from the Kenner on a shelf day back in the early 80s and whatnot. It reminds me a lot. We talked a lot about George Lucas in this episode and the core Star Wars. We know it's a fable directed at 12-year-olds going on into the bigger adult world and not taking your toys off the shelf. But it's just a warm reminder for me. a lot of what George was putting in there, and even by Return of the Jedi, yes, you even got Gary Kurtz saying, I don't know, the Ewoks seem to be for kids and everything. And I got nothing against the late, great Gary Kurtz. I don't think we have Star Wars without his involvement, though, to be clear about that. But even by then, and you know, Joseph, those darn Ewoks started spawning these conversations of it's just about the toys, it's just about the kids. And I love that George is saying, no, I mean, we couldn't predict the toy stuff, but also, yeah, I love this stuff. I love toys. I love Flash Gordon. I love all that stuff because it helps stimulate the imagination of those seeing these films. And that's the purpose. Stimulate the imagination, teach lessons, teach morality, teach things, tough choices, all those kind of things. And it's all in this magical, mysterious, wonderful, tension-filled storytelling that critics don't fully get sometimes and the kids carry with them. And I just love that.
Yeah, I wonder if Lucas had a t-shirt about people saying mean things about the toys, too, that he wore on the episode 2 set with his all-digital film. Yeah, I love that quote. There are a couple things that I love about it. One, just I think, you know, if you've watched the documentaries of the making of the original trilogy, this is a well-known fact, but I think sometimes not focused on in general societal conversation about Star Wars. That goes back to what we were talking about early on about Lucas just trying to make his visions, right? That when he says, yeah, the toys helped me make finance the films, that it's right. So easy to look at Star Wars, you know, the initial explosion, even to today, in all the merchandising everywhere, and just go, it's all just to sell toys. It's all just to grab more and more money. And you just reframe that to the truth that Lucas struggled to finance, you know, Empire Strikes Back, right? Struggled to keep it all going. Like it's a little indie film. And part of what made it happen is like, hey, the toys, great. Thank you. A lifeline. That it's just so polar opposite than, I'm just going to use these in a cynical way to make money. It's no, I have this vision. I want to share it. And they're helping me do that as I desperately scrape to do that.
Yeah. And it's Alan Ladd Jr.'s losing his job. And even Fox is saying, absolutely not. You can't make the second film. It costs too much money.
Kicked out of the Directors Guild. Yeah, all sorts of stuff. And then for me, I will not go on about this for a long time because well documented how much the toys mean to me. But it just really means a lot for me to hear that out of the mouth of the person who started this all, that they stimulate the imagination. They did for me as a kid. That's why I still love them. I'm doing these fun TikTok videos about action figures. And I realized for me, it's part of the reason that I wanted to do that is because I don't take them out of the package. I don't play with them in the same way, but action figures are still stimulating my imagination of how can I share with people why these silly action figures make me happy. They're still stimulating my imagination, and I am extremely grateful for that.
Yeah, yours, Robert Rodriguez, shooting animatics with his kids and figures. You know, like,
right.
Favreau dumping the toys on the sandbox and playing. I mean, with Filoni, like, yeah, it's all there. And it all comes from a little bit what George is saying here, I would say.
Absolutely.
So that is my number one. But we've reached your number one, sir. Your number one favorite fascinating fact from The Greatest Galaxy. What do you have?
My number one is, I believe, the last one in the book. It is A Princess's Thanks. Here is what is written. Carrie Fisher passed away as episode 9 was in development. Director and co-writer J.J. Abrams faced the challenge of her absence head-on, realizing Leia could not be absent from a story that required her. By using previously unused footage from episode 7, Abrams found a way to include her, something that Fisher cryptically seemed to predict in the dedication of her book, The Princess Diarist. Here's what The Princess Diarist says. And special thanks to J.J. Abrams for putting up with me twice. Abrams said, now, I had never worked with her before The Force Awakens, and I wasn't originally supposed to do this movie, so it was a classic Carrie thing to sort of write something like that, and it could only mean one thing for me. Mm. So this was just a great tribute to Carrie Fisher. A great just mystery of why did she write it that way? And, you know, it evokes the maybe the mysteries of the movements of the Force exist here in our galaxy, too. And it's just a really heartfelt to me thing for J.J. Abrams to say, yeah, you know, it was a quick decision. Should I take on episode 9? How are we going to handle this? And Carrie Fisher seemed to strangely imply that I would take it on. So maybe that's one of the reasons I did is
It's very, very big step back from all of the rancor of who should have directed it. Did they do a good job? All that. And just really steps back to, you know, no matter how big Star Wars gets, no matter how much of blockbusters or box office or toy sales we can discuss, that there is in the creative process the sense of something, you know, personal and powerful and spiritual. And I think this is a really just not a fun fact, a moving fact to get to that, the heart of there are all these personal and spiritual ideas going into it, too.
A lot going into it. Tough decisions, sad decisions had to be made. You know, we get all that. But I love the spiritual nature of this. Also, Carrie, if you had asked her, what'd you mean by this? Come on, it's Star Wars. You never get away. Or
who knows what she meant? Yeah.
Who knows? All that kind of stuff. And just a reminder of how wonderful and unique she was in her own way. And it reminds me too of I watched a little bit of that Rise of Skywalker doc the other day, just kind of had it on. It's just, I don't know, man. It just reminds me, JJ, he has some great care and concern for this franchise and these films. You know, he was there to play and was there to put himself and his heart and soul into it. And he knew that things like this could not just be done flippantly or to sell tickets or to make you taste. It was all, you know, he had to weigh a lot of decisions, and he did so because he does love Star Wars. And so I'll take that away from this as well.
Yeah. And I guess final thing for me is I'll say the same thing about J.J. Abrams that I said about George Lucas. I think you can, you know, disagree with their choices and you can personally dislike them, but I think they are made with care. And I think one of the choices that he and everyone involved made with care that I really appreciate is I think this film, Rise of Skywalker, does absolutely everything it can to center and celebrate the legacy of Leia and therefore the legacy of Carrie Fisher. And that is one of the many reasons that I celebrate that movie.
Absolutely. I'm there with you on that. And I love everything you brought to this conversation, Joseph. What a wonderful, fun little book. You know, we could have talked about a lot of different things in here, including some of the sillier things and some of the interesting little numbers and timelines, but some great, I really think, powerful, affecting facts in here. So great job, Pablo. Star Wars Fascinating Facts, Store Lore and History from the Greatest Galaxy. It's out there. It's not a commercial for it. We purchased the book ourselves, but it was just a fun little book. And I love celebrating all sides and histories of Star Wars, past, present, and future. So thank you, Joseph, for coming in for this one here. As we start to sign on out, I'll let you know where we can be found. We're online on Twitter at Force Center Pod, on Instagram, YouTube as well. Facebook page is Force Center Podcast. Get an Audible audiobook on us for free by going to audibletrial.com/ForceCenter. You can get merch at tpublic.com/user/ForceCenter. And you can support us directly at patreon.com/ForceCenter. I can be found online at Ken Napsok or my website, KenNapsok.com. If you want to watch Joseph's fun TikTok videos, well, Joseph, tell them where they can find you.
Yeah, you can find me social media, Twitter, Instagram, TikTok, all with the same handle at Joseph Scrimshaw. And if you're interested in any of my other various comedy pursuits, including that episode of Obsessed all about soundtracks, you can find links to all those things on my website at JosephScrimshaw.com.
Do it, my friends. That is it for this week, I should say. Star Wars has been ranked.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So, Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel. A pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.